welcome to Worlds Apart. Days after publishing a new national security strategy advocating for a strong U.S. hand in Latin America, the Trump administration doubled down on Venezuela, seizing a large oil tanker and promising more to come. What does this American swashbuckling in the Caribbean portend for Caracas and the region as a whole? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Paul Dobson, a political commentator based in Venezuela. Mr. Dobson, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much for your invitation, Oksana.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say before that the U.S.'s primary objective in picking on Venezuela was economic rather than political or geopolitical. You believe that Washington is after Venezuela's resources first and foremost. Are you still sure about that, though?
I think the recent theft, the piracy of a Venezuelan oil tanker in the Caribbean, which potentially could have been carrying up to $95 million worth of Venezuelan oil, really reaffirms my point. This is not about narco trafficking. This is not about migration. This is not even about political change, in my opinion. This is about securing access to Venezuela's vast and extensive and diverse natural resources for U.S. multinational corporations in a preferential way and displacing the other multinational corporations which are currently extracting it to a very lucrative way these resources, so displacing the Chinese firms, displacing the Russian firms, and displacing the Turkish, Iranian, and other firms which are working in Venezuela today.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I'm asking you whether you're sure or not is because, you know, over the last couple of days, there has been a notable shift in the American security posture, at least on paper. And I'm talking here about the publication of the new national security strategy, which essentially pronounced illegal migration as a potential casus belli for the U.S. military intervention in the region. So I'm sort of wondering whether the Trump administration may also be using Venezuela as a staging ground for testing its declared security primacy over the Western Hemisphere.
Without a doubt, I mean, the U.S. government is very apt at setting up alternative narratives to hide its real objectives. It'll be a political nightmare for them to come out and say, we're going after Venezuela for its oil. This is something they cannot say, of course.
Well, come on.
So they have to dress it up.
The Trump administration has had no doubt about, you know, stating its primary objectives when it came to, let's say, Greenland or, you know, in developing its ties with the Gulf countries. So why would it be in any sort of... Why would it be shy in declaring its objective, its, you know, mercantilist objective in Venezuela then?
I think this is more about the domestic home audience for the Trump base. We all know about the problems in the MAGA movement right now. We all know about the criticisms about his forever wars after his declarations that he was not going to do this. So he has to be a little bit more careful now than maybe on the campaign trail about how he dresses these things up. So he's talking about narco-terrorist rug-running rings. He's talking about immigration. He's talking about issues which really hit home to an American audience. That doesn't necessarily make them true, of course.
I've heard a number of analysts already dubbing this new document as the Donro Doctrine, a mix of the 19th century sphere of influence thinking and Trump's own personal fixations on illegal migration, drug trafficking, and supply chains control. What do you make of this quote-unquote vision? Do you think it's executable?
Well, I think firstly, we have to point out that there is definitely continuity there. The Monroe document or the Monroe doctrine wasn't something which existed and then stopped to exist and it's now being revived. It's something which has continued during the Democrat or Republican US governments, their efforts to dominate what they consider to be their backyard, and in particular the Caribbean and the northern part of Latin America. And so, call it as we may, this is basically the same policy the White House has been following for the last 100 or 200 years. There's nothing new here.
It does suggest making great power politics a little bit more regional and perhaps a little bit more transactional. Do you think Russia and China, which until recently have had substantial political and economic interests in Central and Southern America. Do you think they could be sort of motivated to pull back a bit from the continent in a tacit exchange for less of the nefarious U.S. meddling in their own neighborhoods?
Well, this is essentially what I think the U.S. wants. This, I think, is their primary objective. There's a very clear level of competition between the U.S. attempts to penetrate Venezuela's resources and the current successful penetration by Russian, but principally Chinese, but also Turkish firms. And I think one of the major objectives is precisely this, is about putting America first, in Trump's own words.
Putting America first in terms of stealing the other country's natural riches, because, I mean, the Russians, the Chinese, the Turks are there in on, you know, business deal terms, whereas the American administration is currently employing quite, 19th century means. You yourself called it piracy. Do you think the tanker will be returned sooner or later?
It's very unlikely. It's very unlikely. But I think here it's important to point out, Oksana, that the attack on the tanker should not be interpreted as a wider naval blockade on Venezuela. This isn't about cutting off Venezuela's trade. This is about, in my opinion, applying a filter to Venezuela's trade. Mm-hmm. This is oil which is not clear whether it was going to Iran, whether it was going to Cuba. It certainly wasn't going to the United States. But there is oil going to the United States. Chevron is currently working in Venezuela, has secured a deal to work in Venezuela for the next 25 years, which is almost unheard of, and currently accounts for nearly 25% of oil extracted from Venezuela's grounds. And this oil is going to the United States. So it's very important to point this out, that there is high levels of U.S. trade right now. And the attack on the tanker is about dissuading trade with other nations, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also comes at a very interesting point geopolitically, because while I mentioned Russia and China as having strong ties with Venezuela, I think over the last couple of months, these countries, especially within the BRICS format, have been somewhat distancing themselves from the Maduro government, have they not?
There has been. Venezuela currently has very dubious ties with some of the BRICS players. Obviously, with the Russian government, with Moscow, the ties seem to be very close. Only this week, there was a call between Maduro and Putin to reaffirm their alliance. But when we look at ties between Venezuela and Brazil, for example, they're on very shaky ground. The Brazilians have taken a moral approach to the Venezuelan elections last year, which were highly questionable. And essentially, Lula has said, until the results are released from this election, and I should point out they still haven't been released over a year and a half later. So Lula says, until these results are actually released, we can't have Venezuela inside BRICS. And this has caused great disdain in the Maduro government. But also, if we look at the relations between Maduro and China, China was a very close ally of the Chavez governments here in Venezuela, and for the first few years under the Maduro also. But Venezuela, under Maduro's lead, failed to pay back a number of large, extremely large credit lines which were extended to it by the Chinese government, and currently owes around $60 billion, which is more or less half of all of the debt of Latin America. And this, of course, has really changed the relations between Beijing and Caracas. Mm-hmm.
The Maduro government is used to relying on anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist rhetoric to criticize the actions of the U.S. government. But I get a sense from, reading at least the Russian newspapers or the Russian media that, it impresses both Moscow and, I think, to some extent, Beijing, much less these days. These two nations, China and Russia, are usually sort of portrayed as your default autocrats of the world. But why do you think they're distancing themselves from the Maduro government? Is it only economic, or do you think they themselves may have qualms about the popularity and the legitimacy of this particular government with the Venezuelan people?
I think it's probably a mix of all of these factors that you mentioned, Oksana. The Chinese, who are essentially pragmatic when it comes to their diplomatic relations, are very aware of this $60 billion debt. And I think politics doesn't come into it that much for them. They were very annoyed that the Maduro government stopped paying back his debt and essentially have extended no more projects or credit lines to the government since. Mm-hmm. However, I think in terms of Russia, there is a different mix of factors, more political. But when we look at Brazil, for example, talking about BRICS players, the politics really comes into it. This isn't an economic move. Mm-hmm. This is about questions about Maduro's legitimacy, about the corruption in his government, and essentially a very, very low approval rating within the Venezuelan people.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about the Russian policy, what comes to mind here is the Assad government. And you know that the Kremlin has been quite supportive of it for many years. It provided military assistance against the regime change. But over time, I think as the Kremlin saw that the government wasn't very effective in bringing peace and economic development to the country, the Kremlin's position changed, and it essentially allowed the regional dynamics to take their course. I wonder if something similar may be happening in Venezuela as well, at least as far as the Russians are concerned.
Many analysts are drawing parallels between what's going on in Venezuela right now and the last few years of the Assad regime. There are many differences, many, many differences between the two countries, two peoples, the two cultures, and the two political environments. But however, there are some similarities. We've seen over the last year, as Maduro's popularity ratings have dived, essentially, he has taken a much more authoritarian switch in his government in a similar way that Assad did towards the end of his presidency as well. And we are seeing Maduro essentially being backed up now by the armed forces with very little support base amongst the country. So, yes, many are looking to Syria to see what might happen next.
Mm-hmm. Now, regime change has long been an almost casual consequence of American foreign policy. But do you think the Trump administration actually wants the Maduro government to disintegrate at this point of time? Wouldn't that create many more problems for the White House, especially when it comes to illegal migration and drug trafficking?
Well, this is a very important question, Oksana, I think. And the answer cannot be simplified to a yes or no, unfortunately. The reality is that the current Maduro government has granted significant concessions to U.S., large U.S. transnational firms to come and work in Venezuela. We currently have the lowest minimum wage in the world. Trade union rights are torn up. It's basically a haven, and even including a tax haven, for large firms to come into Venezuela, invest, and exploit the Venezuelan workforce. We know that Maduro has offered this to many U.S. firms. I pointed out Chevron, as one example. But we can also look at trade in coffee, in cacao, which is up by 1,500%, it's up by 600% in the last 4 years, supposedly during sanctions. And so we can see that right now the US economy is doing well off the Venezuelan trade. However, there are areas of the economy which US firms would like to penetrate and are still unable to do so, particularly in the Orinoco mining arc and in the basic materials, the iron and aluminium in the east of the country. Now, we know that a change in government, if, for example, there was to be a change with a far-right figure, Maria Corina Machado, assuming the presidency, this government, led by her, would open up all of these sectors to the US firms. This is clear. And I think at the moment, the Trump regime will be evaluating. They won't be unhappy with the economic relationship with the current Venezuelan government, despite all of the rhetoric, despite all of the showmanship and the circus going on in the Caribbean. Economically, trade is going up between Venezuela and the United States. And they'll be weighing this off with the potential gains and the costs of overthrowing this government and putting in an even more favorable government.
Now, I've heard some analysts suggest that the U.S. military buildup is at least partially an effort to put a pressure on Maduro's internal circle and perhaps inspire some, not so much a regime change, but, you know, some internal power restructuring, especially given that the United States still offers a $25 million bounty for Maduro's arrest. Do you think that's kind of a scenario is likely?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. The ruling party in Venezuela, the PSUV, from its initial inception in 2005, was what many describe as a multi-class party. It was a party brought together by numerous different sectors of society. So in it, we have poor peasants, trade unionists, workers, but we also have large industrialists, large landowners, and import and exporters. This means that it's a fragmented party. There is no unity within the party. Anyone who has looked at Venezuelan politics over the last 20 years will see this. Mm-hmm. There has always been strong currents within the party and competition between these currents. And this is a determining factor in the way that their policies go. So by pushing one of the other factions within the party to displace a faction led by Maduro, the US government is in fact looking for this. It's looking for a fragmentation and a removal of the Maduro-led faction within this party.
Okay, well, Mr. Dobson, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
For 20 years, we've broken all the rules you invented.
You're watching RT.
Antum tushahiduna kanat RT.
Están viendo RT.
Vous regardez RT.
Here's the today.
You claimed we were brainwashing your citizens. You accused us of running troll factories. You screamed that we buy off bloggers and celebrities. Made Trump great, and then made him great again.
Russia today is capable of conducting information war.
We know that RT possessed cyber capabilities.
To ban Russia today because of the nature of propaganda.
Get in their bullhorn.
Are we a propaganda bullhorn? Well, it's time to say sorry. Sorry not everyone has heard us yet. We're always working on making our bullhorn louder.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
You know what? The planet I've been living on land.
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Paul Dobson, a political commentator based in Venezuela. Mr. Dobson, before the break, we mentioned the U.S.'s new national security strategy, which posits, at least on the paper, that Washington should refrain from imposing democratic or any other social changes on foreign countries, but at the same time, it also provides for the use of military force to stem illegal migration. What do you think that leaves Latin and South America in their relations with Washington?
Well, migration, especially illegal migration from Central America or South America, is one of the contributing factors to these problems within some U.S. cities and essentially this policy by the MAGA base of the Republican Party. The large number of Haitians, of Colombians, Panamanians, but also Venezuelans. We have to remember, overall, 25% of Venezuelans have left the country since 2013, 2014. So a quarter of the country is now outside of the country. This is a huge percentage. And this creates, without a doubt, certain pressure on U.S. healthcare systems, housing, and other areas. And it's definitely an issue. However, whether this gives the U.S. government the right to intervene in Venezuela? No. Without a doubt, no. This is an excuse.
Now, do you think it may change the calculus on the part of the regional governments, including perhaps the Maduro's government? Because you mentioned a large number of Venezuelans having left the country. Do you think it may provide an additional impetus for regional elites to actually consider and work more seriously on their country's long-standing economic and social challenges?
I think it's unlikely, especially when we look at, for example, the position taken by Gustavo Petro in Colombia has not been a position of where he would say, well, you know, maybe let's have another look at the labor law we just passed. You know, it's a defying position. And this is very similar to the position taken by many governments across the region, essentially saying you cannot come and dictate or pressure, in this case, pressure us into changing our policy. And Maduro has essentially taken the same approach. The difference with Maduro is that his legitimacy is severely questioned, his popularity ratings are very low, and he has caused an economic disaster in the country. Right now in Venezuela, the monthly minimum wage is less than $1 a month, whereas a basic food basket for a family of four is well over $700. Now, these figures don't add up. And for him to reverse these policies would be a massive rollback for him and a concession which he's not willing to make, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you say before that the current state of Venezuela is, quote, a million miles from where Hugo Chavez had left it or where he wanted to take it. And there are very few mechanisms for Venezuelans to actually, change it in a democratic or any other social way. First of all, what kind of mechanisms are you talking about here?
Venezuelans have a very deep-rooted belief in democracy. Even before the Chavez victory in 1999, but essentially since his victory, Venezuelans have learned that problems can be solved through democracy, national consultations, elections. And this was almost with a single swipe undone in 2024, when under Maduro's orders, the authorities failed to release the results of the presidential election. Today, Venezuelans look at democracy and they say, this can't solve our problems. We tried that and it didn't work. And this is extremely serious because this means a generational rollback in something as important as belief in choosing our own leaders.
Venezuela is still associated with socialism, or at least the efforts to build it. Given the economic and political and social realities on the ground, do you think it's a lost cause at this point of time?
There's no socialism in Venezuela. There never has been socialism in Venezuela. And currently, we are a million miles away from socialism. Despite what the government say, despite what they call themselves, despite the word and the rhetoric they use to try to rally up support from Cuba, from Vietnam, and other countries where there is socialism and they believe in socialism. Right now, if you look at the distribution of the means of production in Venezuela, you look at the distribution of wealth, you look at the levels of grassroots participation in the country, it's impossible to conclude that there is even an ounce of socialism in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, there is a joke here in Russia that the difference between an optimist and a pessimist is that the pessimist believes that things cannot possibly get any worse, and an optimist states that they definitely can. I mean, it's a very bitter joke, and my country has gone through, you know, a very difficult period of time when I remember back in the late 80s, you know, the officials were talking about socialism and, you know, that great love for the country and needing to defend it against foreign imperialists. But things were progressively getting worse and worse to a point when, you know, Russia was very close to ceasing to exist as a sovereign country. As far as you are concerned, what's the perhaps best or the most realistic course for Venezuela at this point of time?
There is still deep-rooted patriotism in the vast majority of Venezuela. I'm still convinced that the vast majority of the population still identify at some level with a project initiated by Hugo Chavez, which essentially revolved around redistributing the oil rent and producing better material conditions for the people, healthcare, education, transport, housing, etc. These are basic ideas which I think, if resurrected, the majority of the people would rally behind. However, as you pointed out, as I said in the past, today we're a million miles away from this. And I think any efforts to start to rebuild the country have to focus around national independence, patriotism, autonomy, but also social justice, also an effort to try to revive these great advances that were made in the country between 1999 and 2013, which have now almost entirely been rolled back.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the reasons many would point out why many of the advances have been rolled back is because of the Western and primarily the American sanctions against Venezuela, which have been pretty difficult. Although, as you pointed out yourself, there have been some exceptions, for example, granting oil extraction rights to U.S. Oil companies. Now, Why do you think, what, as far as you're concerned, what are some of the main reasons for Venezuela doing as poorly as it has been doing over the last couple of years?
There's been no real effort to break down the structure of the economy in Venezuela, which for over 100 years has been based on rentism, on oil, on extracting resources from the ground and selling them to a commodity market. This is the same structure we had 100 years ago, and we still have it today. Mm-hmm. Many governments talk about diversifying the economy, starting to build up a services sector, tourism sector, for example, but none of them actually do it. Today, Venezuela is dependent on its oil income as it was 100 years ago. And I think until this starts to be broken down, we're going to start seeing the distortions in the economy, but also the distortions in the collective consciousness in the Venezuelan society, which this also bring with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Venezuela is not the only country to be under punishing Western sanctions. Russia, Iran, a number of other nations have suffered these substantial limitations, and yet they have made efforts to reach some degree of self-sufficiency. And I think, you know, some of them have been quite successful in this regard, or at least there has been some progress. Why do you think Venezuela has failed to benefit from that kind of policy and learn from other nations that are also heavily sanctioned?
This is exactly the same question many, many on the streets in Venezuela are asking every single day. If Cuba can survive a much severe blockade for much longer, and Russia can survive worse sanctions and still have a growing economy, why did the Venezuelan economy shrink 85% over the space of less than a decade? Now, so what were we doing wrong? And I think the answer really lies in the administration of the economy, the level of corruption. Many government offices are not interested in diversifying the economy because, in fact, they're making money off the imports of commodities and the extraction and sale of oil. And so there's very few interest, genuine interest there to bring about this sort of economic changes, radical structural economic changes the country needs to survive and grow under sanctions.
Now, Mr. Dobson, I think the Venezuelan opposition would agree with many of your points here. And just the other day, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to one prominent opposition figure, Maria Corina Machado, whom you already mentioned. She left Venezuela for that occasion, but still couldn't receive the prize in person. But her daughter received it for her and also delivered a very pro-Western speech about democracy and being willing to fight for freedom. I'm sure this kind of stance is portrayed as very courageous in the West, but is it perceived as genuine and grassroots driven by people in Venezuela?
Well, very few Venezuelans would have actually bothered to watch the ceremony yesterday or this week. Very few will have known much about it. Maybe they'll know that Maria Corina Machado was awarded the prize, but they don't really care. Most understand this to be a Western institution, a Western liberal institution, or Western liberalists, and has very little impact here in Venezuela. I also think the Maduro government will be unswathed by what happened in Oslo. I can't see them being particularly alarmed by the fact that she left the country. Now, it has to be pointed out, there are arrest warrants out against Maria Corina Machado. There have been for many years. And many in Venezuela are asking, why hasn't she not been arrested? This is a lady who has quite clearly committed crimes in Venezuela, who has called for a military invasion, who has called for more sanctions against the country. She should be behind bars in Venezuela, not enjoying the support of all of the liberal Western elite in Oslo and the cameras of the world. Mm-hmm. And many are asking this of the current government. Why, like Juan Guaido, like Leopoldo López, who all have committed crimes in Venezuela, why does the Maduro government allow them to leave? Because these people did not leave under under a cloak and dagger. These people were allowed to leave. Why were they allowed to leave and not arrested as the people demand justice?
Well, there are many puzzling things about Venezuelan politics, including the, you know, the ability of American companies to still extract oil in Venezuela officially. But you elucidated us on some of them, so thank you very much for that.
My pleasure, Oksana.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.